hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fact. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. And they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the fallen dusty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be worn. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be worn. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here on FlightResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, here's a very interesting article by a Negro writer named Larry Elder. And it's all about that scandal that's been swirling around now for the better part of, I guess, it's 3 weeks of the accusations of actor and homosexual by the name of, Jussie Smollett. And that was, as you'll probably recall, then on a cold, I believe it was a Sunday evening, 3 weeks ago or so, 2 a.m. in Chicago, he was out walking around. Shouldn't the alarm bells already be going off? Anyway, and he was assaulted by two men, presumably Donald Trump supporters. One of them wearing a MAGA hat, that's Make America Great Again hat, and these two people said some anti-homosexual and anti-Negro things to him. One tried to put a length of rope around his neck as a noose, and the other one threw bleach on him. Magically, of course, he escaped this attack, or he's number 2-1, and lived to tell the tale and to complain that he'd been the and they said something like, you're in MAGA country. Yes, on a darkened Chicago street. That should have sent off alarm bells, but the media ran with it. that uncritically reporting every word, and of course the predictable denunciations followed. We cannot tolerate such stuff, various politicians said. Of course, it was all blamed on President Trump. It's as if President Trump had gotten up early in the morning, gone out on the streets of Chicago to deliberately. Oh, well, in the meantime, of course, it turned out to be what I would think any reasonable, objective observer might have suspected, that it didn't happen. It's a hoax. But it plays the victim card and, pays big benefits as long as you've got foolish or worse white-hating people, including white-hating whites, ready to believe it, to believe the absolute worst of other Americans. That's just safe because you support President Trump, that you would beat up on a black homosexual, and that these two individuals just happened to be carrying, one of them a length of rope and the other a bottle of bleach, on a cold, wintry Chicago night. And, that should have set off alarm bells, along with the fact, how would people who did not know him, presumably, know that he was homosexual, in order to throw a couple of homosexual insults at him? Anyway, the writer here in the Toronto Sun is a Negro, and he writes, Smollett supporters rooting for a modern lynching. They wanted that. Representative Maxine Waters, and she's a nutcase, Democrat of California, not only believed black and openly gay actor Jussie Smollett's tale of being attacked by two N-word-spouting homophobic Trump supporters, she and many other big-name Democrats knew exactly whom to blame. Walters said, quote, I know Jussie. I love him. His family is a friend of mine. I know his sisters. I met his mom. And I called already to Jazz, I guess that's him, and I called already to Jazz, one of the sisters, to talk to her about what's happening, what's going on. I'm pleased that he's doing okay, but we have to understand that this is happening for a reason. Why? All of a sudden, do we have people unable to study while black, unable to mow a lawn while black, unable to have a picnic while black, and being attacked? It's coming from the President of the United States. He's dog whistling every day. He's separating and dividing, and he's basically emboldening those folks who feel this way. The Reverend Al Sharpton, who became famous by falsely accusing an assistant district attorney of raping a Negro teenage girl, weighed in. He said, the smallest attack is only a reminder of the times that we are living in, that people feel empowered to express their hate and feel that there will be no accountability. The president should have said, my brand shouldn't stand for that. This hate-filled climate is being set by the President of the United States, who gets the award for climate setting, if he is not at the fault for the direct act. So if Trump didn't directly organize the attack, then he at least inspired it. Now that's according to that arch liar and race baiter, Reverend, in quotation marks, Jesse Jackson. Al Sharpton. The Reverend Jesse Jackson released a statement, quote, hatred against another simply because of who they are is like acid rain. It falls from the top down and pollutes the environment. Former Vice President Joe Biden tweeted, what happened today to Jussie Smollett must never be tolerated in this country. We must stand up and demand that we no longer live give this hate safe harbor. That homophobia and racism have no place in our streets or in our hearts. Senator Kamala Harris, a Democrat of California, in a tweet called the alleged attack, quote, a modern-day lynching. Well, no, there's a big difference between a lynching and the attack. Even in, as the attack was explained, a few words were exchanged, and it would seem like a symbolic gesture of trying to put a noose around his head occurred, and some bleach was thrown at him. He wasn't murdered. Okay. Larry Elder continues in his write-up, "Isn't it good news that this story is false? Isn't it good news that Trump-supporting people are not patrolling the streets at night, armed with bleach and a noose, to find, attack, whitewash, and lynch black and gay Trump bashers? A People TV host actually said she was, quote, hoping and praying. Those were her words. That Smollett's story was true. Why did so many uncritically buy Smollett's story? One reason is that that an Axios poll last November found that 61% of Democrats believe Republicans are racist, bigoted, or sexist. 31% of Republicans feel that way about Democrats. And most Democrats and members of the media believe Trump is a racist. So why doubt such a juicy story that falsely advances two narratives? Trump is Exhibit A, that racism remains a major problem in America, and if Trump is a racist, therefore so are his supporters. But what does it say about America's alleged systemic, structural, and institutional racism when, in 2019, the cupboard is so bare that racist attacks have to be manufactured?" And that's an extremely good point. Last year, in a span of a few weeks, the three black motorists claimed they were victims of racism by white cops who pulled them over. One, a reverend, was the president of a local branch of the NAACP, that's the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He posted on social media a long, detailed description of the alleged interaction with the cop whom he claimed racially profiled him and made harassing comments. In another case, a Negro female motorist took to social media to say she had a traumatic experience in Virginia when she was pulled over for speeding and threatened by a white cop who degraded her as an, quote, African-American. And a viral post by a civil rights, quote, activist claimed a Texas trooper sexually assaulted another black woman following a traffic stop and then arrested her for DUI. But they were all unaware that they were being recorded. The tape shows all three were lying. The cops involved were courteous, polite, and respectful. The Negro motorists lied about the white cops. But if not for the recordings, who knows what might have happened to the careers of the officers. That's right, just the accusation is enough. You know, the old Anglo-Saxon concept of, come on, we got to reach way back in memory for this one. I don't think. Innocent until proven guilty goes right out the window. But anyway, and because of the recordings in these three cases, the cops were exonerated. It turned out that the events simply never happened. As to the belief that racism remains a serious problem in America, can we agree that nirvana is not an option? In a nation of 330 million people, bad actors abound. After all, one survey in 2017 found that 7% of adult Americans believe chocolate milk comes from brown cows. Oh my God. And these guys can vote? That works out to over 17 million adults. And a 1997 Gallup poll found that 4% of Americans believed Elvis was still alive. But today's definition of race relations pretty much comes down to this: how black people feel about white people, and how white people feel about black people, feel about white people. Racism has so receded as an impediment to progress that the new terms become necessary to describe offensive so-called racist behavior, such as microaggressions. You know, maybe you looked at me the wrong way, or you didn't pay enough attention to me, or you didn't smile when you talked to me. This means whites are racist even if they don't think they are, because of their white privilege. If white people spend as much time thinking about how to oppress black people as black people think they do, white people wouldn't have enough time to oppress black people. A very good point, and well made. And the shameless thing is that even though the Jesse Smollett accusations are being proven to be be complete mischief, not just wrong or mistaken, but a deliberate hoax spun out there to garner sympathy for him, and most importantly, to browbeat the producers of the show Empire into giving him what, you got it, a pay raise. So that's what it was all about. Gimme more money. Now, wanting to get more money is perfectly legitimate thing. No problem with that. But to lie, as he did, and in the meantime, to spread false accusations against Trump supporters in general, and by implication, Donald Trump in particular, is just plain evil. It's not just dirty tactics. Fine, there are dirty tactics in politics, but it's not just dirty tactics. It's just plain dishonest. It's wrong. It's evil, and should be so denounced. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Here's an interesting clip about a guy named Jordan Peterson, and this is an ABC. This is ABC Unmasked. And in a great confrontation with the
Canadian professor and psychologist Jordan B. Peterson is a cultural critic who hates Marxism, political correctness, and the radical left. Plus, he likes giving feel-good self-help advice like this.
Life is a fatal disease. It's a concern.
Jesus. He also says things like this.
If you have your children in a school and they talk about equity, diversity, inclusivity, white privilege, systemic racism, you take your children out of the class.
More context and clips, please.
Peterson gained national notoriety in the fall of 2016 when he spoke out about a federal bill on gender expression and a U of T policy to call students by their gender pronoun of choice.
Why should your right to freedom of speech trump a trans person's right not to be offended?
Because in order to be able to think, you have to risk being offensive.
There are a lot of videos on the internet of you destroying or obliterating people, and they get a lot of views. So if you could destroy me in this interview, we'd really appreciate it.
You like that?
Yeah, not a lot of people watch our show.
I can't guarantee it, but we'll see what happens.
Do you ever watch those videos when you're feeling down about yourself? Do you just watch those videos and go, yes, I destroyed that person?
No, no.
Roll.
No, no.
Come on!
No, that doesn't happen.
Let's talk about your book.
Okay.
It's 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. There it is. Now, you've connected a lot with a lot of young men, lots of different people, but young men particularly seem to, you know, find something in your message. Yeah. I'm a young man. I'd like to be improved, please.
Yeah.
I want to stop being a pathetic weasel.
Yeah, that would be good. Are you a pathetic weasel?
Well, I'd like to.
You seem to be doing all right.
I'm doing fine.
Yeah, well, so you're not as pathetic as you might be.
Rule one is stand up straight with your shoulders back.
Yeah.
I have terrible posture.
Yeah. It's not so bad. Maybe you have a good tailor and he's like shouldered up your suit nicely.
Are you flirting with me, Dr. Peterson?
Well, not intentionally. Oh, you are very attractive, though.
I feel so great. I'm 28 years old. I can't cook.
Yeah.
I've tried to quit smoking about 6 times. Rarely exercise.
Yeah.
Regularly use recreational drugs.
Yeah.
I'm a vegetarian who ordered butter chicken on the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Haven't been in a relationship that lasted longer than a year since 2011. Hate my job.
Uh-huh.
Never remember anyone's birthday. Still renting. Don't know what Bitcoin is. Haven't read a full book since 2012.
Yeah.
Including yours.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
If I would have known that, I would have never showed up for the interview.
Which part? Which part
of the whole thing? It's just a mess.
It's fucking weasel.
It is. Yeah. There's no excuse. There's no hope for you, I'm afraid.
You're big on people cleaning their room.
Clean up your room. I don't know how you can go out and protest the structure of the entire economic system if you can't keep your room organized.
I don't clean my room, but I do pay someone to clean my room. Does that still count?
Yeah, well, it's a metaphor, obviously, you know. And the thing is, it's not that easy to put your room in order. It actually requires a lot of thought. You have to think about your closet, all right? What should you be wearing? Where are you going to put everything? No, you have to think about how you want your room organized so that you can do whatever it is that you want to do in there, so that the room compels that, or at least allows it to happen. If you do it right, you learn a lot. And the thing that's interesting about it is you can actually do it. Most people have a room. It's like, there's a place to start, man. It's a little corner of the world that's actually under your control. It's like, see what you can do with it.
What are the limits of that idea, though? Because you can have a lovely, clean room, yeah. But if for my generation, you know, we're looking down the barrel of climate change, we can't afford a house, some people can't get work, university education is unaffordable. Like, there are these huge, massive problems in society and the political economy that are also going to, you know, screw us over in the big picture that the clean room isn't going to necessarily fix.
If you're going to fix complicated problems, you have to learn how to fix simple problems first. Then you get good at it. I'm not saying that young people don't have things to be concerned about, because life is a concern, right? I mean, life is a fatal disease. It's a concern. You're not on top of it. There's always more challenge than you can take on, in some sense. But complaining about the structure of being and attempting to reorganize massive social structures, especially when you don't know the first thing about them, which is generally the case, is just not advisable. And the universities, you know, they teach young kids, young people, 19, 20 years old, that they should be out attempting to rectify massive social organizations. It's like, you wouldn't go and try to fix a cruise ship. You know, things are complicated. You can't set your own room in order. You can't set your own family, your life in order. What the hell makes you think you're ready to take on something like the political system? That's hard. You're going to mess it up, man, for sure.
I feel like now's a good time to let you know that the ABC is the home of postmodernism and neo-Marxist thought. And I just got our equity and diversity plan here.
Oh, I see. That's nice. You've got a little hammer and sickle on there, and that's quite cute.
The ABC's equity and diversity plan for 2016 to 2018 has targets of 50% women senior executives and 20% women technologists. Mm-hmm. Is that bad?
Yeah.
Why?
Because the game of dividing human beings up by their group identity ends in disaster, no matter who plays it and no matter what the reasons are. That doesn't mean that, you know, in principle it might... Perhaps, who the hell knows? I don't know the internal workings of ABC. Maybe it would be better if 20% of the women were technologists. Maybe it's a radically misogynist organization. I tend to doubt it, but perhaps it is, and perhaps that should be rectified. But these sorts of quotas, they're a terrible idea for 50 different reasons.
What about looking back over history? You've written the idea that women were oppressed throughout history is an appalling theory. They haven't had a great time, though, have they?
Who has had a great time in history?
But men have had less of a...
Really, have they? Have they? By what standard? By what standard?
Well, I'm just saying, if you're a woman...
How about war?
It took longer for women to get the vote, and women belong to their husbands, and in this country, one woman dies every week from domestic violence, a man dies, like, once a month, I believe, in the same cause. Like, aren't there some clearly obvious things that women are...
There are inequalities in the catastrophes that the genders are subject to. And so, look, first of all, there's some things we got to get straight. History's a rough business. Everybody had it rough. In 1895, the typical Westerner lived on less than a dollar a day, which is absolute poverty by today's standards, right? And so people were brutally poor for almost the entire course of human history. It was rough. You say, well, did men or women have it worse? It's like, well, you know, that's a complicated question. But one of the things you can say is everybody had it pretty damn bad. And apart from the pure catastrophe of existence that was shared, say, more or less equally between the genders, like, most of the time, men and women helped each other. Like, women raised their sons, you know? Husbands protected their families. I'm not buying this whole, the sexes have been at each other's throats the entire history of mankind. It's like, no, wrong. And then one level deeper than that, I don't like the whole game. The whole game is, let's divide people into groups and contrast their oppression. It's like, fine, play it, see what happens. You're not going to like it. We did that in the 20th century, right? The right-wingers played it in Nazi Germany, and left-wingers played it throughout the communist world. And all that happened was that we stacked up the corpses, millions of them. It's not a good game. The equity game, that's a bad game.
Bad game?
Bad game.
You don't want to read this just to be sure?
If it says equity, it's a bad game. Because it means equality of outcome.
Right.
Like, equality of opportunity, anybody with any sense is for that.
For my bosses watching, I have read this, and I fully endorse its message, and will continue to crusade, comrades.
Who did the little cover design?
Michelle Guthrie.
No.
Yep.
Very funny.
Thank you.
Very funny.
Dr. Pearson, we're out of time. Thank you for destroying me.
No problem. Thanks for the interview.
Of course. Enjoy your time in Australia.
Thank you very much.
He's the kind of guy people either love or hate. Clinical psychologist Jordan B. Peterson has been described as one of the most influential thinkers of our time, but also as an alt-right figurehead who spouts conspiracies. Despite what you think about him, there is no denying the professor's impact, his videos amassing more than 45 million views on YouTube. Crusade against free speech.
Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on White Resistance Radio. .com. Here is a, I think, extremely well done and shocking report, and I'm happy to pass this on. And this is the tactics of immigration, and this is by Vertigo Pollux. This video explains the politics of replacement, that is, the ethnic cleansing of Europe, North America, and Australia, imposed on us by cultural Marxist elites over the past half century. This video explains the politics of replacement, the ethnic cleansing of Europe, North America, and Australia, the sentence is repeated twice. It explains the evil plotting to bring about our replacement and demise by orchestrated mass third world immigration. This is why Merkel let in over 1 million Middle Easterners to Germany in 2015-2016. This is why Justin Trudeau and his Somali Muslim refugee immigration lawyer, Minister of Immigration Ahmed Hassan, refuses to close the border to tens of thousands of Nigerian scammers, Haitians, and others flooding across from New York State. This is why a collaborationist Swedish government has admitted tens of thousands of unassimilable, mostly Muslim, rape refugees who prey upon Swedish women who, when they complain, are admonished by feminists to be quiet or risk being branded as, you know what? Come on. What are they going to call them? You know. That's it, racists. This video has this in the version I'm sending out. There is the graphic of Marine Le Pen, a very beautiful looking white woman, and she's quoted as saying, "Make France great again. This is France." It's a picture of a young Brigitte Bardot with her beautiful blue eyes, central face, blonde hair. Not this, some woman with shifty eyes in a kneecap. That is one of those head-to-toe bags with just a slit for the eyes. Very, very powerful. I'm going to play this for you. At least I'd like to play this for you. Here we are, I hope. Now I'm not quite sure why we're not able to play this. We do seem to have our problems, don't we? If you just bear with me for a second, maybe we can get this old thing here to work. It's extremely well explained, and I like it. And let's see if we can get it this time. There we are. By Vertigo Pollux, and this explains the tactics of immigration, the tactics being used.
Immigration is a form of demographic genocide which, either by design or consequence, results in ethnic cleansing. In addition to this, Western governments are effacing their European populations by promoting a variety of other schemes, such as miscegenation, abortion, homosexuality, gender dysphoria, and white guilt. But immigration has been by far the most successful approach towards complete replacement, and if this does not drastically change within the next two decades, Europeans will be the first race to become extinct. So who within the political class is behind immigration policy, and how have they been able to coercively open the floodgates? Whether the discussion begins with the diaspora after the Bar Kokhba revolt, or seeks to understand the role played by fifth columns during the fall of the Visigothic kingdom to Muslim forces in 711 AD, there has been a continuous thread over some 2,000 years of a Jewish influence within the lands inhabited by Europeans that has sought to undermine the integrity of cultural boundaries and, more crucially, the conception of borders. Through traitorous invitation, political realignments, or financial leisure demand, these alien forces have often contrived the social conditions and historical circumstances where kingdoms and nations went to war, peoples fled their homelands, and for those caught in between, a life of brutal misery. In such a frustrating and vicious cycle, a continuous pressure has been placed upon the European race. Never has a group of people been so crushed over such a length of time. Even the Asian and African kingdoms had centuries of relative peace here and there. But for simple Europeans, generally speaking, a farming culture, which had natural ties to the land and each other, the past 2,000 years has been a nightmare. In the gristmill of the present era, we have observable evidence of a Judeo-globalist conspiracy to open Western countries to the importation of countless non-white peoples whose sheer numbers will outproduce the native European populations. This current state of affairs can be traced back to the mid-1960s, when, in just a few short years, every Western state changed, without any popular consent, the laws governing immigration policy. In every case, Jewish leadership was responsible for these changes. The resultant breakup of the dominant homogeneous traditional European culture ensured that a small rank-and-file coterie maintained its grip over Western nations by excluding any possibility of a larger, racially European competitive group from rising to positions of influence. Moreover, the social stability within many European nations gradually became compromised as the original ethno-fabric unwound, creating greater mechanisms of control against the native populations, which further reinforced the absolute dominance by this coterie over state and culture. The following is a short list of Western nations who adopted these democidal immigration policies after 1960 and the Jewish ringleaders behind these efforts. The Hart-Celler Act, United States, 1965. Senator Jacob Javits played a prominent role in the Senate hearings for the 1965 bill. Javits authored an article entitled Let's Open the Gates, in which a proposed immigration level of 500,000 people per year for 20 years was requested, with no restrictions on national origin. Congressman Emanuel Celler, who had fought for unrestricted immigration since the 1920s in the House of Representatives, was the main writer of the legislation. Leo Pfeffer, who wrote many treatises and books that acted as softening propaganda for open immigration, also co-conceived the legislated material. Norman Podhoretz was a former communist Comintern sympathizer turned neocon who became a close associate of the aforementioned men. He wrote numerous articles promoting open immigration. And Jewish organizations such as the American Jewish Congress, the Jewish Federation, the ACLU, and B'nai B'rith all filed briefs in support of open immigration before the Senate subcommittee during the hearings prior to the Hart-Celler Act. The Migration Act, Australia, 1966. Walter Lippmann played a crucial role in pressuring the Holt government to do away with racial profiling against non-white immigration. He was president of the Australian Jewish Welfare Society, which, among other services, offered financial support and housing to non-white immigrants to Australia. John Malcolm Fraser was a cabinet member during the Holt government who went on to become the Prime Minister of Australia in 1975. His mother's maiden name was Wolf, born of a South African Jew who emigrated to Australia. Despite being Minister of the War Cabinet, his Liberal Party values did not stop him from advising on an easing of immigration restrictions. This sympathy no doubt gave him a leg up on his competitors when he campaigned for Prime Minister a decade later. The British Nationality Act, United Kingdom, 1981. The Labour Party, true to its Marxist roots, began a series of nationality acts from 1948 onward that established the rule of jus soli, whereby citizens of the British Commonwealth could now migrate to Britain. Ralph Miliband was born in the Jewish quarter of Warsaw. He emigrated to England in 1940. After the war, he joined the Labour Party despite his hatred for English culture and proceeded to become an intellectual proponent of the New Left. His writings and lectures proved influential in the reworking of several British Nationality Acts over the decades, as they became increasingly more open to non-white immigration. Maurice Edelman was a lifelong member of British Parliament. He was a Francophile and admirer of David Ben-Gurion. His efforts over the years as a Labour Party MP included a number of published works, several of which sought to influence how Britons saw themselves, Like many of his ilk, he considered the peoples of Britain to be the ancestors of migrants. Canada, Germany, Sweden, France, Denmark, Belgium, the Netherlands, and so many others also had major overhauls to their national immigration policies during the same period. The mainstream narrative explained this phenomenon as a development of lower birth rates among natural Europeans. Then there was a financial reasoning behind the influx, one which argued the fallacy that Western countries had a desperate shortage of low-skilled workers. And now the latest explanation for mass immigration has been given, that Europeans need to become more diverse, despite the demonstrable fact that about 97% of all hair colors and 96% of all eye colors attributed to human beings belong exclusively to the European haplogroup. The explanation that we are never given is simply this, that an internationalist cartel operating within Western nations has designs on governing the planet at some point in the future. They have shared this common goal since the Age of Revolution, and this in part helps explain why their long-term plans always go unnoticed, because they think in terms of centuries, while Europeans can only see from one generation to the next. And it matters not what one calls them, liberal, globalist, socialist, communist, cultural Marxist, or Jewry. In toto, they are one and the same. They desire a one-world cultural order ruled by a centrally controlled government with all of humanity under its thumb. And for them, European nationalism since 1848 has been a barrier to that goal. Therefore, Europeans must simply be replaced. This philosophical point is essential to understanding their religion, or globalism. Much of the world already operates in some manner like it, but conditionally on a micro level, a subsistence version of it, a pseudo-communism, if you will, due to poverty in Africa, culture in China, or caste systems in India. However, the individuality and free-spirited nature of Europeans and their ability to organize and express these traits through cultural celebration or nationalism is a roadblock to world government. Even when given various forms of socialism to live by, many European cultures could just not adapt collectively or metaphysically to it. And once it becomes understood that the purest form of this doctrine, communism, was simply a Jewish-designed belief system to persuade Gentiles to abandon the notion of property rights, relinquish their free will to an authority that ruled over them, and divorce themselves from the values of their culture and kindred, inasmuch as they related to the state, then it makes perfect sense why the Europeans have stubbornly held their ground through dozens of the world's greatest social cataclysms, of which the Bolshevik Revolution and World Wars were only a part. And now the final push looms large. An army of culturally alien, hostile peoples have been brought into our midst, many of whom are males of military age. They want to pair up and breed with native European women, which our elected governments offer up to them. They want their own laws and cultural norms to be dominant. They defile our religious and historical spaces while waiting for the day when Western governments finally say to them, "Now go, kill the white menace." And to think that it all began with just a few modest initiatives, some cosmetic changes to our immigration policy only a few short decades ago, when a man like Enoch Powell could deliver a speech that still meant something. Yes, there will be rivers of blood.
This is a very grim warning and refers to Enoch Powell's speech just over 50 years ago, 51 years ago, he warned.
It seems that a deteriorating society is exactly what political correctness strives for. But just what is political correctness?
This is just a little premature, but
ideology. Marxism translated from economic into.
But what Powell was warning about was the rapid the change of British society brought about by mass third world immigration. He argued that in large numbers these people were unassimilable and that they would change British society and that their presence would erode British rights. And it would be wonderful if he'd been wrong. It would be wonderful if he'd been an alarmist and just overstated the case. Unfortunately, he wasn't. And the results have been catastrophic. The erosion, partly to accommodate mass immigration, of basic rights like freedom of speech. To make a criticism of Islam today opens you up to the risk of imprisonment. Recently, a busload of British soldiers were at a bus stop, and some of them took selfies with anti-Muslim populist campaigner Tommy Robinson. They were the Islamic Conference of Imams demanded the punishment that they be thrown out of the British Army, and they were in fact disciplined. Police spy on citizens listening in public places for people making anti-Islamic remarks. People who protest against political Zionism, like my friend Jez Turner, the organizer of the London Forums, sent to prison. Comedian and satirist, songwriter and singer Alison Chabot, punished by the courts for singing on the internet. And you had to, it wasn't as though she imposed her songs on anybody. You had to seek them out, and if you're interested, choose to listen to them. Why? Because, well, her songs were critical of some of the claims of the so-called Holocaust survivors. And she made fun of some of the more ridiculous claims, like Irene Sisblatt, who wrote a book some 30 years after World War II, once other people were cashing in on their so-called Holocaust remembrances. She wrote that when she went to Auschwitz, she was a teenager apparently back then, and the family entrusted its fortune to her, which is in the form of diamonds. In order to not have these stolen, bought by who? Fellow Jewish prisoners? Well, you know, that question has never actually been adequately explored, even by her defense. She supposedly swallowed the diamonds every evening, and the next day went through her shit and separated them back out and repeated the process. I mean, it's so disgusting. It also, I suggest, challenges belief. Where would you go every day to privately do your business and be able to collect what you excreted and go through that, presumably with water and so on, to find the diamonds again, store them somehow, I guess, on your person, and then once again do it the next... It defies belief because it's not believable. Even the person who brought the charges against Allison, and he's the head of the CAA, that's the Council Against Anti-Semitism, and they're very, very well politically connected in the United Kingdom. A fellow by the name of Gideon Felder said, well, she may have, not got all the facts right. And then, of course, he hadn't even read the book, but he was stoutly defending it. But, you know, when confronted with the unbelievable, and all she did was to poke fun at some of these ridiculous claims. Oh, no, she's in a heap of trouble. She was convicted, sentenced to community silencing on the internet, for a while, and then about 240 hours of some sort of community service, or she calls it slavery, and that's what it is. Now, all of this has been inflicted on the United Kingdom because of immigration, in order to accommodate the invaders. The rights of the native people have to go by the board. And I warned about this. Back in 1991, I said that one of the costs of multiculturalism was going to be our basic rights, our basic freedoms as Canadians. Now, I wish that that somehow I'd gotten it wrong. I wish that, you know, maybe I was overly fearful or I exaggerated, but no. Legislation has been brought in, so-called human rights legislation, the horrible Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act, which basically did not allow truth as a defense and made any comments on the internet that were likely to expose to hatred or contempt an actionable offense, which left you open to fines and gag orders. Eventually was repealed by the Conservatives in 2016, but not before it had damaged the lives of a number of the people whom I know well and whom I defended in human rights tribunals. Oh yes, multiculturalism and the third world invasion, immigration invasion, which this video absolutely correctly blames our elites for. You know, so the third worlders didn't decide to invade. They did take advantage of the fact the door was kicked open for them, for nefarious purposes. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side. I mean, gotta take my musical break right now. And this is I think a really talented country and western singer, Heather Miles, singing an old Ray Price tune, "Crazy Arms."
Thank you.
Heather Miles, Crazy Arms. This is another blonde country western singer, Becky Hobbs.
Thank you all so much. I wrote this song with Candy Parton, and Candy showed up at my door one day in a cowgirl boots and a cowgirl outfit and the smaller of her boots and said, I want to know you before we make love. And I said, but Candy, I'm not that way. Anyway, we wrote this song. Alabama recorded the song first. It was on their 40-hour week album. Randy Owen told me that it wasn't going to be a single, and I cried all the way to Conway Twitty, and Conway Twitty took this song to number one. Now, back when Conway had this song out, I opened some shows for Conway, and he was the most wonderful man in the world. We had a lot of chances to visit on his bus, and he told me that whenever anybody pitched a song to him, he didn't look at the lyric sheet because he did not want to know who wrote the song. He did not want that to have any influence on who, if he cut the song or not. And I pitched him a song once that, and he told me about this. He said, you pitched me a song one time and he didn't feel it was right for him, so he played it for Tammy Wynette. That's the kind of guy Conway Twitty was. Songwriter's best friend. I think this is good, Ben. Check one, two. Bye.
That's Peggy Hobbs. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Actually, again tomorrow, same time, Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever, played by the 48th Highlanders of Canada. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here made to wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together. The thistle, shamrock, roses entwine the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword ever shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever.